The Final Edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for people who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
I'm Jeff Kreisler.
And I'm Tony Hendra.
And this is the Final Edition Radio Hour.
So, Jeff, I think our fans...
Both of them.
...should know that we now have a new brand identity that costs several hundred thousand dollars. It's summed up by our new slogan, which
what?
Is...
Wait, what? I knew nothing about this. How many hundred thousands of dollars? I'm an equity holder in this goddamn company.
And the slogan is... Ferocious Disrespect.
That's it? Each one of those words cost half a several hundred thousand dollars?
Nah, forget the money thing. I'm just yanking your knowledge. What do you think?
I don't know. I kind of like satire with teeth.
Yeah, but it raises questions. I mean, what kind of teeth? Human teeth? Dog teeth? Shark teeth? All very threatening. I mean, do we actually bite people with our satire?
It's a figure of speech, Tony. A metaphor. I don't know.
Biting people is a felony in every state except Alabama and Louisiana.
You know, ferocious disrespect has overtones of bestiality, too.
It does not. It implies great respect for anyone's right to speech or belief, and ferocious disrespect for what they say or believe.
How about something more positive, like satire, I'm loving it, or things go better with satire, or I'd like to buy the world a joke.
I have ferocious disrespect for everything you say.
And that, folks, is what you're about to get for the next 60 minutes on...
The Final Edition Radio Hour.
The Final Edition asks the man on the street, what do you think of Brian Williams' suspension for false stories about himself?
I think it's a goddamn shame they're not going to let him into the Hall of Fame, you know, because I thought he had a good career and this stuff happened later on.
I didn't like that guy when he was honest.
What did Brian Williams know, and when did he know it wasn't really happening?
Truth is relative. And by that I mean my relatives lie to me.
So if all the politicians lie, and then the newsmen lie too, doesn't that make it the truth?
Well, now he can get a job on Fox News.
What's this got to do with the people kicking that robot dog?
I always liked Brian Williams, especially the Pet Sounds album.
Leave Brian alone! Leave Brian alone! I love Brian! Leave him alone!
And that's the way it isn't.
Maury Povich's whole life is a lie.
The night was dark. The clouds scuttled across the moon. I clamped my microphone between my teeth and crawled with the platoon through the tangled jungle, watching, waiting for the enemy to strike. Suddenly, boom! And where Jeb had been was just a pair of smoking elbows. I grabbed my pistol and I fired into the undergrowth. Damn you, I roared. This one's for Jeb!
Brian Williams, recalling Vietnam.
This President's Day, come on over to Abe Lincoln Lincoln. I've got 47 vehicles on my lot, and I'll tell you what. I need these cars like I need a hole in my head. That's why I'm practically giving them away. Help me emancipate these bad boys before they get sold off in a car auction to some rich white douchebag. Come on over and buy a Lincoln from a Lincoln this President's Day weekend.
From the consumers of 50 Shades of Grey comes the second most anticipated film of the year. 50 Shades of Gay, The Alabama Way.
I'm a college student doing an interview for a newspaper. I just have a couple of questions for Mr.
You can call me Master, and I'm gonna call you Negro.
I'm only technically half black.
Shh.
So, Master, to what do you owe your success?
Cotton. Lots and lots of cotton.
I don't know nothing about cotton.
All you need are strong hands. Strong yet supple hands.
For picking cotton?
And occasionally my...
Got me looking so crazy right now.
I think it's time you saw my secret room.
Holy shit! Are those...
whips my family used on its slaves 300 years ago? Yes.
That is so hot. Ow! Oh! Oh! Oh!
This post-Valentine's Day, experience a love story like never before. As Alabama acknowledges same-sex couples.
I don't feel like myself when I'm around you.
That's because I own you.
Oh! 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 Oh!
Today on Morning Fear, can a card game give you AIDS?
Plus, can you resist putting your tongue on an electrical coil? Our lifestyle expert says, bet you can't.
That's today on Morning Fear.
You thought they were just for warfare and mass murder, but that's all about to change. Drones, now for all the truly personal and significant human interactions you don't want to do in person.
What is this? Candles? Roses? A drone?
Please remove the ring from the docking area. Will you marry Christopher?
Yes! 1,000 times yes! Thank you, drone!
When texting just seems too impersonal, say it with a drone. Big game clashing with your godson's christening?
Do you renounce evil?
I renounce it.
Say it with a drone. Daughter playing Annie in Annie?
An excellent performance, Caitlin.
Gee, thanks, drone. Or should I say, Dad?
And when it comes to the birth of your son...
it's a boy.
Oh, honey, look, a boy.
I am overwhelmed with love.
Our drones have got you covered. Sending a drone to perform your most intimate tasks is always totally appropriate. With their clean white design, a drone is a welcome guest at any wedding.
A toast to my sister Maggie and her soulmate James.
Drones can personally deliver gifts of up to 3 pounds.
Oh, sweetie, what a lovely brooch.
Happy 80th birthday, Mom.
And with their handy vibrate feature, you can even use one as a proxy to make love to your wife.
Your eyes are as deep as the oceans and as beautiful as the stars.
Whenever you need to make an impactful human connection from one heart to another, drones have got you covered. Offer your sister some encouragement at a radiotherapy appointment. Tell your son that you couldn't be more proud of his Harvard acceptance letter. Or say all those important last words to your dying grandmother.
I love you.
For all life's most meaningful moments, say it with a drone.
The battlefield was filled with a stench of gunpowder and death. Union forces surrounded us like a fishhook as rain began to fall. Spirits were low as I took my microphone out into the meadow. All I could see from miles around were bodies littering the ground, blood soaking the red soil as crows circled in the sky above us. "Look, General Robert E. Lee," I said. "I think we're done for." He looked me square in the eye and said, "Not while I am standing."
Brian Williams, recalling another classic moment from his journalistic career.
The Final Edition Radio Hour will be right back.
And now, some more of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Nixon Ford makes it clear, let the competition beware.
Hi, folks. I'm Dick Nixon of Nixon Ford. I'm not related to Richard Nixon, and I'm certainly not a crook. But I have tapped the phones of my competitors, and let me tell you something. Their prices have nothing on mine. This President's Day weekend, our prices will be dropping like a Christmas bombing on North Vietnam. Mustangs, Explorers, F-150s. They'll all come cheaper than a Vietnamese hooker. So come on down to Nixon Ford this President's Day. Would I buy a used car from me? You bet your sweet ass I would.
Today Today on Morning Fear, electricity doesn't work. We'll show you how you've been fooled.
Plus, your heart can give you a heart attack. We'll talk to a guy.
That's today on Morning Fear.
We're back with the Wake Up Fiesta Crew. I'm Dick Macy, here partying all morning with Dr. Barbecue.
Come on now, sir.
And the chick.
Oh, Dick, please.
So, the chick, what do we have in the news today on this crazy Tuesday morning? And please, keep all your clothes on this time.
Oh, Dick, please. Okay, Bruce Jenner was in a horrific car accident that left one person dead.
You know he's half a chick now.
Oh, Dick, please.
You know that, Dr. Barbecue. Bruce Jenner is working on being a chick.
I say, come on now, sir.
It's true! You know, he was the king of decathlons, right? You know, before the Kardashians. Now he'll be the queen. I wonder if his booty will be better than Kim's.
Come on now, sir.
Oh, Dick, please.
I bet he caused the accident.
Oh, Dick.
I bet he was checking his hair, doing his makeup, wishing he was in a convertible. And there he goes, smacking into everyone, killing everyone.
Oh, Dick, please. One person.
Only one? Come on. Where's that decathlon effort? He's working too hard on being a chick.
Oh, Dick, please.
Hold on a minute.
That's not your constant catchphrase, Dr. Barbecue.
No, hold on.
Look, if you're gonna switch up, say something about tractor pulls or guns and NASCAR and beer.
No, I won't. What are we doing here? We're really doing a bit about this? Someone died. A person was killed. And we're making fun of that? Who are we? What are we doing here?
Maybe you're right, Dr. Barbecue.
It's Daryl.
Maybe you're right, Daryl. Maybe we should just acknowledge this news and let the family mourn. It's all a terrible tragedy.
And you guys are going to bring the morning commute down. Ratings, you asshats.
Whoa, make me a sandwich, the chick.
Woo. Come on now, sir. NASCAR and beer.
There you go, Dr. Barbecue. Hey, after this break, we're going to have some razzing about Whitney Houston's drowning daughter, and the chick is going to talk Grammys. It's the Wake Up Fiesta Crew. We'll be right back.
I used to meet women by calling them bitches on the internet comment threads, but the women I meant were always bitches. Then I found OK Stupid. OK Stupid is the matchmaking service for people who aren't that bright and want to start a family.
I was tired of drinking and vomiting and waking up to a guy posting pictures of my tits on Twitter, so I went on OK Stupid and posted pictures of my tits while I vomited. That's how I met Daryl.
At OK Stupid, our detailed questionnaire determines your misguided beliefs, racist opinions, and poor critical thinking. Then we match you with someone who'll probably turn abusive out of sheer inability to communicate.
Ever since meeting on OK Stupid, my old lady and I have been drinking every night and getting into fights. But she'll change.
Daryl and I have been together for almost 2 years. He'd be here now, except he's married, which isn't really a problem.
I think my girlfriend and I are ready to have children and then not vaccinate them.
It's okay to be stupid on OK Stupid.
Right from the start. Deep within them lies a smile that never dies to thrill and still my heart.
And now the first in a series that may only end up being just one thing. What if everything ran like the internet?
I've never been to a prostitute before.
It's $100 for straight lay, $150 for two positions.
Okay, what if I'm a 19-year-old millennial and I'm not used to paying for anything?
There's a free version, but you get ads.
That seems fair.
All right, take off your pants.
Uh-huh.
And while we're having sex...
Uh-huh.
I'm going to advertise other prostitutes.
What?
Lolita is available for elegant, discreet encounters of all tastes. You can find her at the Hotel Francis.
Okay.
Simply Amanda is a horny housewife with a wild side. She'll spank you for being bad.
I've been pretty bad lately.
Starshine has a big ass and will do you real good. She bets you got a real big dick, too.
Hang on. All your pop-up ads are for other prostitutes?
Well, so far.
That's who's buying ads.
And these hookers also have free versions with ads?
Correct.
So I have sex with you for free while you give me the names of other hookers who will have sex with me for free and give me the names of other hookers?
We're still working out the kinks on the economic model.
Yeah, well, hey, speaking of kinks...
This has been What If Everything Ran Like the Internet?
Today on Morning Fear, is your head too small?
Plus a new kind of cancer that's airborne. We have an expert who's heard of it.
That's today on Morning Fear.
Welcome to the 7 Habits of Successful People, the most important audiobook you will ever hear. We've talked to such luminaries as Elon Musk, Carlos Mencia, Kirstie Alley, and that black guy from that one show. Their advice can help you get to the top and stay there. Just like that black guy from that one show. Success habit number 1.
Chew your fingernails down to the nub. Don't stop when you get to the skin.
Success habit number 2.
Stalk your ex-girlfriend. She said she loved you once. Those words are supposed to mean something.
Success habit number 3.
Let small things eat away at you. Small things matter.
Success habit number 4.
Judge your children based on looks.
Success habit number 5.
Live alone, or alternatively, live with your parents.
Success habit number 6.
Imagine you only had a year to live. How would you live your life? You'd probably kill a stranger just to see how it felt. Like a street person. Lure them in with drugs or the promise of a hot meal. And then, bam!
Success habit number 7.
Pick a sports team and then get really serious about it. Wear a team jersey and beat up some guy in front of a cheesesteak place.
Now you know the 7 habits of successful people. And your friends don't. Why even tell them?
I held up my microphone to the cross. Into my hands I commend my spirit, said Jesus. And then he let out a loud cry and darkness fell upon the earth. And the cloth of the temple was rent in two.
Brian Williams there, reporting from the crucifixion.
With luck, we'll be back with more of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Hi, welcome back. This is Tony Hendra. At Sundance this year, a new documentary came out about the National Lampoon, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, which was quite remarkable, really, because Sundance doesn't usually accept documentaries about anything funny. As you know, the Sundance Comedy Festival is a very small one. Anyway, this documentary, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, did extremely well and was glowingly reviewed, and it's basically one more step in the rehabilitation of the glory years of the National Lampoon, which is basically its focus and the story which it tells. Earlier in this program, a year or so ago, we interviewed an author called Ellen Stein. And Ellen had taken the first step, probably, in this rehabilitation with a book called That's Not Funny, That's Sick, in which she, too, spoke about the National Lampoon as a highly influential comedy hub, if you will, and covered much of the same ground. We thought that the appearance of Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead might be an excellent opportunity to revisit that interview. We have with us today Ellen Stein, who is the author, or authoress, of the latest Lampoon and possibly most definitive Lampoon book, That's Not Funny, That's Sick. And I am possibly going to interview Ellen Stein, or possibly Ellen Stein's going to interview me, which she never did for this book, even though I was at the Lampoon.
I can explain why.
Okay.
You were busy finishing your book.
Right.
Going Too Far, available at all good bookstores. And so you didn't want to be interviewed for the book.
That's absolutely true, and I
would have loved to have had you.
I was trying to get away with it, but obviously I can't. But one of the things I do just want to say to our listeners: there have been several books about the National Lampoon, and most of them follow the same rough chronology that I established in Going Too Far, which was the first account of the National Lampoon from 1970 to its to the beginning of its decline in the early 80s. Most of them have also tended to focus on the
the various peccadilloes and quarrels and feuds and so on of the Lampoon with a kind of relish that seems completely out of place for a magazine that that's now 40 years old. But Ellen's is most, in fact, Ellen, I should say it to you. I mean, what really impresses me about the book is that you've set the Lampoon in its historical context. And not only that, but you finally, I mean, I think there have been sort of hints of this earlier, but finally you set the Lampoon down as an enormous influence on American comedy in the latter half of the 20th century.
The internal dynamics are there because you have to explain why things evolved the way they did. But what was really interesting to me is the context, the larger context, and also, I mean, so much the material stands up. Because one of the reasons I looked at it from 1970 to 1980 was because that's when it was in its heyday, and after that it became a product as opposed to more creative expression that for right. some just managed to, for various reasons, which I hope I outline, become commercial by sheer luck almost. It's a way of looking at the 70s, which is very often dismissed as, you know, disco swinging and oil crisis, that's it.
And self-indulgence and the me decade and all that stuff.
And that right. sort of swinging.
Right. which I think actually I've always felt, well, obviously I have a certain vested interest in this, but I mean, I've always felt the 70s actually were a period of great sort of opening up.
That's what I was about to say. So I was really looking at how the 60s turned into the 80s, and a lot of the sort of fault lines in culture and politics that we're still arguing about now started then, and the Lampoon, you know, without waving a flag on one side or the other, explored these, and so a lot of the material, which stands up incredibly well, that there was that piece in the politics issue about ultra-right. It was a parody of the ultra-right commercial, and it had Nelson Rockefeller, of course, was the now deceased Reed, the liberal Republican or moderate Republican,
right.
saying, "One day I overheard a top leader in my party. You wouldn't know his name in a million years, but he's on the board of 147 top corporations. Say to a mediocre party warhorse, 'Too bad Nelson's such a goddamn pinko. What do you say we give him the old heave-ho?' He recommended ultra-right. All it is a powerful mixture of blatant racism and crude fear enhancers combined with simple-minded rhetoric. In just weeks, convictions I had held for 20 years were gone, and with them that low-key washed-up feeling that could accompany defeat in a major election." So I was editing this book for publication during the primaries in 2012.
Nothing's happened since 1972.
Could have come right out of his candidate's mouth,
I thought. Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I think that's very much the case, and I mean, in the sense that people seem to have forgotten that, for example, the 70s were the absolute, probably the best period that Hollywood ever went through. I mean, 70s movies, one of them, but I mean, certainly far better than the 60s and far better than the 80s. I mean, wonderful movies were made in the 70s, and not just the obvious ones like Godfather. So, I mean, the culture as a whole gets very short.
We'll make an exception for Spinal Tap in the 80s, of course.
Right. Oh, another movie you didn't actually talk about very much.
I mentioned it, but it's sort of out of the... I really had to be disciplined about stopping at 1980 because
right.
that book is long enough.
But I mean, now that we're together, I mean, it seems to me Spinal Tap, not only in terms of personnel, but in terms of sort of continuation of things that the Lampoon obviously explored first, like rock parody, was an outgrowth of it just as much as Saturday Night
Live.
It's
a whole other book.
That's an idea.
Not just a footnote.
Maybe we should do it together.
Not just a tiny, sort of tiny couple of paragraphs in mine, but a whole other thing unto itself. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, you have, been working at the satire coalface Man and Boy.
Right.
And do you think its audience has gotten bigger? I mean, I get memes on Facebook every day. They're actually quite pointed and good. And has it gotten more diffuse and it's even less relevant? Or is it more The Daily Show, is it more relevant?
I tend to be a little bit of a fundamentalist about satire when it comes to the definition of satire. But because I think satire is a timeless form which needs to be properly defined. And without getting into that right now, because that's kind of boring and academic, I think there are many different things that pass for satire would have satirical intention. For example, I would describe my great friend and I think comedic genius George Carlin as a satirist in just the same way that Juvenal was a satirist. I mean, the way that the sort of slashing surveys of his, you know, contemporaneous life are sort of satirical in the most ancient sense. But I think a lot of things pass as satire, but have the effect that satire ought to have. So, I mean, it seems to me that in the 2008 election, and actually in the last election, the presidential election, I mean, Tina Fey and what she did to Sarah Palin was classic satire in action. And it affected the outcome of the election, no question.
Yeah.
And I wrote a long essay at the time for some academic journal, a right-wing one actually, called Keene Magazine, with Keene University in New Jersey. But it was about the fact that Obama seemed to be, even more than Reagan, completely unassailable. But he didn't give them any edge to peel up. Whereas the McCain and Palin were just insane. I mean, and you cannot get elected.
Yes.
When almost everything you say has a laugh track applied to it, you know. But I mean, that's an interesting point in general, because I do think that satire, which I define as something much more like Colbert, to me is much more of a satirist than Stewart, because he adopts the position and mentality of his enemy, of his target, and that's really what great satire does. It's what Jonathan Swift does. That's what Dr. Strangelove does. I mean, all the great sort of high points of satire. To me, that's the most admirable when you can do that.
The other thing is, I mean, I do spend a lot of time in the book on a couple of your post-Lampoon projects, which I thought, in a way, not the New York Times had even more of an impact than a lot of Lampoon articles.
Yes, I must thank you for that. I've tended to be kind of mushed into the general, it was all such fun.
No.
And it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. Mm. And it did actually, after all the experience I had at the Lampoon as an editor, for which I also thank you, because that was really what I was very good at. I was not a bad writer, but I was a really good editor. And I collaborated really well with people. Mm. So this was my opportunity to sort of shine as Russ Younger said, as the editor in chief, and it was God, it was exciting. It was such fun too,
It was funny.
Oh, it was very funny. I mean, I'd still go back and read Carl Bernstein of all people. You know, Pope dies yet again. Rain is briefest ever. Cardinals return from airport. I mean, that was George Plimpton. He and I wrote that headline together at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And also the lifestyle section was what really cracked me up. The funniest headline was, cocaine, in quotes, a drug, appears popular.
Right.
That's the New York Times to a T right there.
Right, and then they had the graphic of the increasing number of noses from 1978, 1970, whatever it was. You know.
One thing I wanted to use the book to do is to... It isn't a soup to nuts history of Lampoon. Like I said, it starts
not
at the end, ends in 1980. All these people who really liked it in 1980 have written in saying, wait, we didn't do this and that. Different book. I also wanted to use it to sort of shine a light on some other things that were happening that were related, maybe tangentially related, or that Lampoon people worked on, or that fed into Lampoon in some way, that have, I think, been forgotten to some extent, and some extent unfairly forgotten. But the other thing that I wanted to sort of, that I spent a lot of time on, because I liked it, so is the 80s, a look back. And that, so many of those, especially Jeff Greenfield, so many of those articles are so prescient. This was a book, an 80s look back, was actually came out, you explained, was actually came out in 1979, correct?
Mm-hmm. January the 31st, 1979.
And it was like what happened during the 80s. So this was written around 1979, and Jeff Greenfield cites a Supreme Court decision which states that, quote, corporations may spend any amount of money to influence the outcome of public referenda, and that individuals may spend any amount of money to elect themselves to office. We take judicial notice of the fact that money talks. This was satire, ho-ho, like this could happen.
Right,
and then it did.
Yes, actually, that's absolutely true. You actually list many of the things that did actually come true in one way or another.
Mm.
And, of course, we had to wait 30 years for the Congress of Nuts, too. But we finally got that.
And the amicus vitae brief.
Right.
Again, unthinkable, but...
One of the things that I also liked about the book was that you didn't... First of all, that you concentrated on the material, because the material is the one thing that has sort of been forgotten. And it shouldn't be, because, as you say, much of it holds up. And there was nothing like it before or since that I know of. I mean, you cite the Vietnamese baby book, for example, which is a piece I actually had to make O'Donoghue dig out of his drawer. This was a book that was called the Vietnamese baby book, and it was a baby book in all its beautiful sugary saccharin little bows and kisses everywhere, except that the baby in question was one of the babies that had been killed at or injured at My Lai, and so baby's first word was medic, and baby's first toy was a bandage, yes. And so forth and so on. And it was a devastating piece of satire, actually, a genuine piece of satire.
And the theme at the Lampoon also that was interesting is that it was different from things that had gone before, like, say, for example, The Realist, because the production values were very good. It was not totally glossy, but the attention to detail and the, you know, Michael Gross in the art department, the artwork, so the parodies, all the details of parodies, even down to like sort of personal ads, incredible attention to detail. And saying things always looked like whatever it was they were parodying. And I think that's one of the things that made it very different.
Well, yes, I think actually that's the same dynamic that I'm talking about with satire. I mean, I don't think parody is the same as satire. Parody is when you when you take on the style and so forth,
exactly.
Coloration and obsessions and so on of your target, whereas satire is what we've already defined. But it was a very strict discipline, and it was one which made us, I think, much sharper than we were given credit for, because we insisted that everything that you couldn't make fun, as I think Michael Gross said, you can't make fun of a postage stamp unless it's actually looks exactly like a postage stamp, and then it becomes literally 10 times funnier. Mm. Which is why all those parodies, the Pet House was one of my favorites, with all these incredible sexy
puppies,
of cats,
puppies, yes,
with Vaseline on the lens and stuff, just wonderful stuff. But it was really accurate, all the little quirks of design and so forth were picked up on, the logo and Guccione and all that stuff.
So funny, it was a professionalism to it, I think, is what. What is the point to it? And the other thing about satire in the classical sense, and this was, I think, one that the Lampoon wrestled with, because some of it did, some of it didn't. The classical definition aims to instruct, and amusement is a byproduct, as opposed to aiming to amuse, and any instruction is a byproduct.
Yes, right.
So would you say that was a dynamic that existed?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was, and I think there's actually a funny, there's a funny kind of reflex that satirists have had in the modern era, mainly perhaps because of this worry about being called pretentious or whatever, but
serious.
which is they always sort of discount or disown that intention. I mean, as I think you mentioned, the Beyond the Fringe people, who at least in English terms, started all this, were always saying we're not satirists. We're just sort of poking fun at things in a good-hearted way. But in fact, what they were doing, especially in the wonderful piece by Alan Bennett of a Church of England sermon, which is just extraordinary, was out and out satire. I mean, satire in the classic way. He takes on the character of his target and destroys it. And just in the same way, I think a lot of people at the Lampoon kind of were nervous about claiming that they actually had. I never was, frankly, because that was always my purpose, was to try and change things. I mean, in Father Joe, I explain how Father Joe was my Benedictine mentor. And I explain how I came out of Beyond the Fringe. I went in a monk, and I came out a satirist. And I said to myself, save the world through prayer? I don't think so. I'm going to save it through laughter. Mm. And you can see how effective it's been.
Yes, I was thinking about the satiric cabarets of the Weimar Republic that did so much to stop the rise of Nazi Germany.
Yes, exactly. Wonderful. I mean, I think it seems to me extremely hard to do real satire on television. It doesn't matter how officially tolerant television gets. It ultimately, at the end of the day, there is always a corporate sponsor, or there is some kind of, you know, some kind of corporate presence behind it, because it can't function otherwise. And I unfortunately think that's increasingly the case on the internet too. So that
I was going to ask you, do you think that that's one of the things also I look at, is how things don't happen in a vacuum, and the media context affects the material, and that you see that in Saturday Night Live, that, you know, we go into that a lot, where they weren't, you know, it wasn't the sponsors came down and said, oh, you can't do that. But nevertheless, there's always a faint hint of this. And do you think that, as Michael Shamberg said, that once the production costs are so much lower now because of, you know, accessible technology, and there's so many more ways of distribution and fewer gatekeepers, do you think that there is more kind of genuine satire out there as a result, or because they don't have these pressures you just mentioned?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, but that's obviously, that's purely personal, because there is so much, there's just so much video and so forth out there that it's impossible to review at all. And I do think that you know, there are several things militating against it. One is that there are successful corporately owned or run so-called satire sites like Funny or Die and College Humor, which were neither of which are satirical, but both of which are sort of heavy-duty corporate enterprises. Mm. I mean, that's what they...
They assume that sort of tone, but their message...
Yes, as I said once about Saturday Night, the sound but not the fury.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a problem, because they're kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the internet, if you like, all the satirical oxygen.
Except for the final edition.
Well, no, the final edition has no sponsors, and therefore, and also has no distribution. Mm. But we're gradually sort of building it up.
Yet,
and I think the Onion, you know, I think the Onion has a kind of, I love the Onion,
and
the Onion, when I first met them, were great enough and generous enough to say, we owe everything to the Lampoon, which was like the first time I'd ever heard anyone say that, which was in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And they said that's all we wanted to do, was to do something like the National Lampoon. And the Lampoon had sponsors too. So, I mean, it's like there comes a point where...
It's always a trade-off.
Yeah. Mm. But I think in the Lampoon, there was a time anyway, we just didn't care.
Yes.
And we were successful enough, like we were talking under the sponsors to our audience.
Well, it's a rare confluence of circumstances.
Sure.
And that's what I wanted to look at. Why did it work, and why then?
Yes. And I think you very successfully created that sort of sense of time. But I also, as you say, I think one of the things that is tremendously fun and interesting and fascinating about this book, provided you have like some minuscule modicum of historical sense and knowledge, is that a lot of this stuff holds up because it's the issues that were aborning in the 70s have not gone away, and nor have they been resolved.
Yeah, no, that's why this material is still so strong.
It's the last book standing when it comes to the Lampoon too, which is probably, I doubt if another book is going to come out about the Lampoon.
We hope not.
We hope not.
There have been more than
we Lampooners certainly hope not. But it's... But I think one thing is interesting, which is worth stating before we finish, because I think that the one really big change that has happened in the last 20 years or so, 20 or 30 years, is that the rise of what I once called entrepreneurial comedy has made, meaning stand-up comedy, which has sort of fragmented the comedic world into literally thousands and thousands of voices, is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a collective kind of humor that in which there were definitely stars emerged.
Mm. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Right. So I think that sort of militates against it too. And even though you have, you know, practitioners like Carlin and a few of his followers who are still around, it's a form which has conditioned people to be not to be too receptive to this.
Being rugged individuals.
Right. But I think that's another reason why the book is really fascinating, and because it does, it evokes the 70s and the late 60s on such a kind of multi-level in such a multi-level way. So anyway, I mean, I'm very, very pleased you wrote the book.
Oh, and I'm so
very
glad to hear it.
Very, very unhappy now that I didn't get interviewed, because I think you take your revenge on me just a tiny bit.
I did ask several times.
But,
I don't think
I was quite as angry as you seem to think I was.
It's not what I could only go by what people told me. Maybe your bark was worse than your bite.
No, I think so. Anyway, Ellen Stein, thank you so much for coming by and visiting the Final Edition Radio.
Thank you so much.
And we could not have kicked off our interview section in a better way.
This is Tony Hendra. We'll be back after this.
Look out! There's more Final Edition Radio Hour!
Tony, we gotta come up with a promo. Our listeners don't know enough about all the great stuff the Final Edition does. Even when we tell them, it's all this, like, blah, 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 dot, 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 www, URL crap. No one gets what that is on radio. They just tune it out.
Well, I have the perfect way to hold their attention while we give them the goods. When I was at the National Lampoon in the 70s, our most famous cover had a cute mutt with a .38 Magnum to its head and the legend, "Buy this magazine or we'll shoot this dog."
Yeah, I remember that, but how does that help us? It was a visual image for a magazine.
Meet Freckles.
Oh, Freckles? Oh, there. Good boy.
Yay!
What's the matter then?
Also, meet my .38 Magnum.
Jesus Christ, you have a gun? Don't wave that thing around here. Is that thing loaded?
Sure is. Hey, listeners to the Final Edition Radio Hour on Progressive Voices on TuneIn. If you don't stay tuned to this promo while Jeff gives you all the necessary info about our fabulous website and our fabulous YouTube channel and other fabulous stuff we do, I will shoot this dog.
Jesus, man, take the gun out of that defenseless animal's ear.
Give him a good, Jeff.
Oh, my God, poor Freckles. Okay, fine. Hey, listeners to the Final Edition Radio Hour, you want more of what we do, go to thefinaledition.com. Our radio airs on this network on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday at 8, as well as Wednesday at midnight. We've also got an album, we've got a Twitter feed, we've got a great YouTube channel, Facebook, everything you can want at thefinaledition.com.
Now, tell them to tap all that into their iPhones or leave themselves an audio memo.
No, I won't. I told them enough, Tony. I'm calling the SPCA.
Tell them, or the dog gets it. I'm cocking the gun right now.
Okay, listeners, please, write this down. Thefinaledition.com. Thefinaledition.com. Go there for everything you want from the Final Edition, or this crazy old British coot is going to plug old Freckles.
Okay, that wasn't so hard, was it? Come here, Freckles, you dumb old chum. Hey, get down! Get down! Get away from me! Get, you crazy cunt!
Good job, Freckles!
Get him!
Sick him! Oh, yeah, this is Jeff Kreiser for the Final Edition Radio Hour on Progressive Voices on TuneIn. 8 p.m. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday nights. Midnight on Wednesday.
No, Freckles, put that thing down! You don't have opposable thumbs! No!
Today on Morning Fear, your doctor knows nothing.
Plus, fruit will kill you.
That's today on Morning Fear.
This President's Day weekend, come on down to Andrew Jackson Toyota. Just like Andrew Jackson, the president, destroyed the Indians in the Battle of New Orleans, Andrew Jackson Toyota is destroying our competition with low prices. For this weekend only, we're offering zero down, zero due at signing, and no payments for 12 months. You'd have to go back to the Indian Removal Act of 1830 to find a better deal than that. We're slashing our prices, just like President Jackson slashed the pride and the throats of the Native American people. So hurry up and get over here, because our cars will be marching out of the lot in a trail of oily tears. Come on down to Andrew Jackson Toyota and tell them Andy sent you.
Andrew Melkman?
Yes, I'm him.
I'm Derek Lunger. Step into my office.
Thank you. Which chair?
Either one is fine. Except that one.
Oh, sorry.
All right. I've looked at your resume. Very impressive. So, Andrew, when do you want this job?
Well, I think it will provide an excellent opportunity to continue my skills in areas that have always been of interest to me.
Yeah, I had a feeling you'd say that.
Excuse me? Is there a problem?
I don't know if it's a problem, but just looking at your work history, there's something I don't quite understand.
Well, I have moved around a bit from job to job, but that's the nature of this kind of work. You know, you have to go where the work is.
Yeah, I get that. You obviously have a great deal of experience, and it's certainly relevant to what we do here.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
There's no question you're qualified for this position. Even so, Andrew, I feel compelled to ask you a question.
Please, ask me whatever.
Why would you want to work at a dump like this?
I have to admit, I didn't really prepare an answer for that.
You probably think that was a trick to get you to say this place is a dump, but that's not the case. This place is a dump. Nobody likes working here. I personally hate every minute of it.
Well, Derek, my first impulse is to assume you're testing me to find out how much I want this job by creating the impression that this company is not good.
Trust me, Andrew. The boss is a complete asshole. He may be a psychopath. In fact, anyone in a position of authority around here is pretty much a douchebag. Just so you know.
Well, I appreciate your candor, Derek, but obviously I'm not in a position to either agree or disagree with what you just said.
Right, of course. I just thought you should be aware of that before we went any further. The reason I even bring this up is, call it morbid curiosity, I would just like to know what the hell went wrong in your career that made this piece of shit job look desirable to you.
Derek, let me just answer that by saying that you would have no reason to regret hiring me.
It sucks to work here. Honestly, I don't know why you're laughing. Every second I spend under this roof is a nightmare.
Well, I guess I'm chuckling because I've worked in numerous challenging office environments, and I've usually been able to thrive even with conflicting agendas.
You're not going to be thriving, I promise you. The first day on the job, you're going to want to kill yourself.
Derek, that only makes me more determined to set a higher standard for excellence.
I've seen grown men cry like babies just trying to survive here. It's completely demoralizing.
I think the skill set I bring to the table uniquely qualifies me for whatever challenges...
Shut up already! So, do you have any questions for me?
Yeah. When do you think you'll be making a decision?
Believe me, nobody wants this over with more than I do.
I'm sure it's difficult to choose between candidates.
Well, whoever I hire is going to hate my guts.
Derek, I would just like to say that I really want this job, and I hope you'll choose me.
I'm very sorry to hear that. Okay, well, Andrew, I'll be calling you in the next couple of days if we're interested. Thank you for coming in.
Derek, I'm wondering if there's anything I can say that would increase my chances of getting the job.
Yes, Andrew, you could take less money than you expected.
I would do that.
How about a lot less money?
That sounds great.
You don't even know how much less money.
It really doesn't matter. I just want the job.
Okay, but I promise you, you'll really be getting screwed. There's no way you can live on this salary.
The money is secondary to the opportunity.
Okay, I give up. I tried. Nobody can say I didn't try.
Does that mean I'm hired?
Yes, Andrew, that's what it means.
Thank you. You won't regret it.
Of course not. Be here on Monday at 9 a.m.
Great. Thank you again, Derek. Have a good weekend.
You just made the biggest mistake of your life.
Yes.
And now, inside the episode of Girls, with show creator and star, Lena Dunham.
So, in this episode, Hannah realizes that she might have made a mistake going to grad school, and... Oh, what the fuck? You watched the fucking episode, didn't you? If you can't figure out what's going on, then watch it again and give me a goddamned report. What's the point of this stupid segment anyway? All I do is say what happened in the show. That's what everyone does. Togetherness, Game of Thrones, all of them, even Vice. What do people want out of this inside the episode? I decided I could be a little less naked all the time, and Allison Williams should have her ass eaten. There you go. What do you want to hear? Okay, Judd Apatow tells me what the journey of each character should be. That's it. That's the fucking secret. Watch the fucking show twice, and if you still don't get it, watch Cinemax. The girls, they looking around for trouble all sorts.
Oh, God, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's it.
Feels like velvet.
Oh, my God. Rub it all over. That is delicious.
Yeah, that's the spot.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Mmm, baby. Oh, my God. That's
hey guys,
so good.
Yeah. Could one of you please pass the butter?
Oh, sorry.
Sure. Yeah.
Really sorry.
Sorry.
Here you go, Steve.
Here he is.
Thanks.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
Butter. Spread it all now.
Good muffins, Sue.
This ad has been sponsored by the Sexy Butter Council of America. Oh, yeah, baby.
Oh, baby. It's never been this good before.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
For the Final Edition Radio Hour, Will Durst here with a few choice words about watching the death struggle of modern dinosaurs. Kind of fun to look into the tar pits and see these huge, lumbering, antediluvian beasts dig themselves deeper in the sticky issue of gay marriage. For some reason, other people having sex make some folks crazier than drunken squirrels on a telephone wire covered in ice. Judge Roy Moore can't stop thinking about it, which frankly is a bit suspicious. He's the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, who ordered probate judges in the Yellowhammer State to ignore a federal court order and refuse to issue marriage certificates to gay couples. The same Judge Moore, who was kicked out of the same office 12 years ago after ignoring another federal court order to remove a 2.5-ton granite block inscribed with the Ten Commandments from the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building. You could say he's not big on federal court orders. You could also say that Alabama is so far on the wrong side of history, a stegosaurus is closer than a Prius. See, it's not the law that's important. It's what Judge Moore thinks Jesus wants that's important. Muhammad, Buddha, Krishna, not so much. The top adjudicator of the entire state can't figure out that displaying the Ten Commandments promotes one religion over others and is in direct opposition to the U.S. Constitution. George Wallace is alive and well in Alabama. The United Dixie White Knights branch of the KKK released a statement supporting the judge on their website, complete with two spelling errors. Now, couple pieces of advice. One, if you want to be taken seriously, hire a 12-year-old kid familiar with spell check to run your website. And two, if any single one of your positions is ever supported by the KKK, you probably will want to think again. For the Final Edition Radio Hour, I'm Will Durst.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Dan Vitale, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Link, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Rob Miller, Andrew Danish, Leslie Shapira, Ann Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The show is written at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Link, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Leslie Shapira, Jeremy Rayburn, Kate Knowles, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition is produced and directed by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast production by Barry Link. Audio editing and production by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition, LLC. Copyright 2014.